We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Darius Miller.
This is Drew Hardy.
This is Lance Thomas, Tyree Gavin.
Jason Smith.
Anthony Davis of the Wolves Pelicans.
You're listening to.
And you are listening to In the Know.
In the Know.
The Bourbon Street Shots.
Bourbon Street Shots podcast.
All Pelicans, all the time.
Welcome to the show. 105-73. New Orleans, do it again. 4-0. 4-0. Michael, Pelicans' greatest team ever.
I don't really see any other option. I'm looking at the history of other NBA franchises. Can't find one other team that went undefeated. They're like the Rocky Marciano. I just called them an NFL team. NBA team. They're like the Rocky Marciano of NBA teams.
So, I mean, of course, I didn't get a chance to watch the stupid Pelicans game today. And I love watching a blowout, so I really wish I had the chance. I had to sit at home and play Game Developer Tycoon, which is a wonderful time waster if you're looking for it. But we, of course, did have a person who attended the game. So let's bring Michael on, the other Michael, not you, Michael. We got too many Michaels on the site, to talk about the game. And, of course, since Michael and I couldn't see a minute of the Pelicans-Hawks game, we decided we'd bring on somebody who actually was there. So we're joined by Michael Pelliche. He's been on the show before, and he's coming back to tell us all about the game because he was there in Biloxi watching it today. Welcome, Michael.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Was it as pathetic a showing by the Hawks as the box score shows?
The beginning was. It was really rough at the beginning. The Hawks couldn't do anything right. And that, you know, as the game went on, just typically as it does, the game was a game of runs, and the Hawks started to hit, you know, more shots that they're accustomed to hitting. But Corum must have missed like two or three looks that he normally hits. Teague missed a couple looks at the basket that he would normally make. So it wasn't quite as bad. But I mean, they were thoroughly outplayed by the Pelicans.
So I try not to take away too much from preseason games, if anything, but you're kind of alarmed when, at least, you know, following the game as best I could, it sounds like or looks like that Al-Farouq Aminu hit four jumpers in this game. Was it fluky? Did it seem like you noticed anything different about his form? Does he seem to be a little bit more confident doing it? Tell me. And the listeners, get our hopes up or crush them. What's up with Aminu's jump shot?
I was actually pretty pessimistic last year that he could ever develop a whole lot of skill. And I'm not saying he's ever going to be a great shooter, but the way he shoots now, I mean, you can see the ball at its highest point, which is a pretty nice improvement from last year. I don't know how to even explain how high that ball went. But it looked good today. He looks confident in it. He's not trying a lot of times to dribble, you know, dribble like a one dribble pull up and shoot it or anything like that. Most of the time it's catch and shoot, and he's not as out of control as he was last year. So it looks like he's improved.
So he only grabbed 3 rebounds, though. Which would you prefer, him going more on the boards and just ignoring those? Or were they important? Were they in the flow of the offense and he needed to be knocking down those shots to make the offense work?
So I have to choose between rebounding and scoring. I'll go with scoring. I'll go with scoring.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Another thing that I noticed, I didn't hear any comments from Monty consciously saying that this was a reason, but in the previous games, we saw Morrow start next to Jrue Holiday. In this game, we saw Austin Rivers start, and maybe I'm just I'm reading too much into it here, but it seems like giving another ball handler, putting another one on the court next to Jrue Holiday, would maybe help alleviate some of the pressure we saw in the couple of the preseason games, and reduce the turnovers. And whether it was conscious or not, that was a result today of having Austin on the floor. Did it seem like those two shared the ball a lot, shared responsibilities, or was Jrue still the dominant ball handler and playmaker when he was on the court with Austin?
In regards to your first question, yeah, it definitely did help having another ball handler on the floor, Jrue. They actually had a run when the Hawks started coming back was when they only had one ball handler on the floor at one time. And the only ones that were there today were Rivers and Jrue. And when one of them was on the floor, it wasn't too good. And they had Roberts at some point when he was basically doing all the ball handling. That wasn't really working too well. So having two of those guys on the floor at the same time helped a lot. But when Rivers and Jrue were out there, I would say Jrue was still obviously the lead guard. He was handling the ball more than Rivers was, but if they had to kick it out to someone else, they could initiate their offense from the opposite side of the court, and it wasn't so stagnant as it was a few times, I guess, during the preseason this year so far.
So following up with Austin Rivers, he actually hit some free throws, but the question I always had when I was watching him during Summer League was you saw him go to the hoop aggressively over and over again, and yeah, he was getting to the hoop. He was having better success finishing. He's been okay this preseason with finishing his shots. He was okay in this game, not exactly what you'd want. But do you see so many of those horrible? Did you see many of those horrible forays to the hoop where he was going to the basket, whether there's guys there or not? He was going to try to lay up with his right hand, whether there's a guy on his right hand or not. Or was he being a lot more clever and tactical about how he's doing that?
I think part of it is that he's exploding better. He has a lot more quickness than he did last season, at least on his first step. I think that actually mentioned that, that he was hurt last season. That was kind of making him a little bit slower. But that definitely helps. I feel like he's a lot better control this year. He doesn't just kind of, it's not rim or bust for him. He'll pull it back out and he'll reset the offense if he has to. And he's just a lot smarter about how he plays. And tonight it was much of the same. He had his moments. He had a walk. They got him for a carry. They actually called Roberts for a carry as well tonight. He had a couple of mistakes, but in general, no, he's in much better control. And he looks like a legit NBA player now.
And I mean, just looking at the box score, it looks like the only player the Hawks really could depend on in this game was Al Horford. I'm going to assume Steemsma was covering most of the time he was on the court. Am I right in that assumption? And overall, what did you think of Greg Steemsma's play in this game?
Steemsma was on him, I think, the majority of the time. I have to check. I can't remember exactly who was on him besides Steemsma. I know that at a couple points they had different personnel on the floor, and so Steemsma obviously wasn't defending him from the bench. But Steemsma played him okay, I guess. The easiest thing to say is that he didn't look bad defending Horford, but at the same time, I don't think he was ever a threat to really stop him. So Horford was kind of doing what he wanted with Steensma. He was facing up mostly, and Steensma's just not quick enough to keep up with Horford. So, he was either sagging off and giving him a shot, or, Horford was, if he was playing too tight, Horford would just blow right by him. So he didn't do a terrible job. I wouldn't say that, but I wouldn't say he did a great job. But more generally, I remember the first play of the game, Al Farouk showed a guy baseline. I can't remember who it was. And then Steemsma, he hit the ball off the guy's leg and it went out of bounds, so that was his steal. And then he had a couple other plays where he impacted the game more off the ball. than he did on the ball. But tonight was better. It was much better than what he showed in the preseason. And I kind of, the thing I'm just curious to see, he looks a lot less aggressive. And I don't know why that is, but he's not as aggressive as I remember him as with other teams.
And we did get a couple minutes of Ryan Anderson and Anthony Davis playing together. Did you notice anything there? Did the spacing seem to improve greatly? And how did they look on the defensive end?
Man, I wish I could answer this question because this is one that probably people have more interest in. But I don't really recall the time together. I think I was actually down on the court getting ready for the promo. So I think I missed a good bit of time. I'm sure we'll do that later. But no, I didn't see him play together a lot. I saw Rhino play a good bit, but I don't remember AD playing with Rhino. And I think that was when I was downstairs.
Oh, just,
sorry. I know, that's so terrible. I have to ask Jason about that because I didn't see it.
Yeah, we're going to have to bring on a completely different guest now. So basically the biggest question I have, though, is we've now had two different posts about Jrue Holiday and the turnover problem. And but Anthony Davis is averaging 3 turnovers a game now.
Okay.
So Anthony Davis, should we trade him because he turns the ball over too often?
I think we probably should. At least get it, you nip it in the bud. Just get rid of him now before his value goes down.
Thinking maybe we trade him to Indiana for David West.
Yeah, we can get D-West back for some and one.
So how did he look up there? I mean, this is the most frustrating thing about this preseason. I've managed to see about 3/4 of actual basketball now in 4 games. It's awful that the NBA does this to its fans.
Yeah, it really is.
But again, 27 minutes, 23 points. I mean, I made the joke before that he's scoring at almost a point per minute, but it's actually true. I mean, I think he's scoring at like 0.9 points per minute at this point. So how amazing did he look out there, or is it all in the flow of the game? Because last year, like, he would get 20-point games, but you never felt like he was dominating anything. Mm-hmm. He was just scoring where he could. Is he still scoring where he could, or are they actually going to him as the offensive mainstay?
Most of his great offense tonight kind of came in the flow of the offense. He actually faced up. He was playing Millsap, and it was interesting. I was watching him attack Millsap, and Millsap's really quick because he's undersized, obviously, but he's still a very good player. And Millsap, he can shoot over, but I think it took him a little bit of time to figure it out. He kept trying to dribble past him, and the ball would always wind up getting deflected here and there. And a lot of the times it didn't wind up in a turnover, but it would, you know, more or less, the ball was loose and it could have been a turnover. But what he started, he was just hitting every jumper he hit, like he took. He was hitting everything. And I remember, obviously, he's always working off the ball, so he'll get, you know, putbacks and he'll get alley-oops and stuff like that. But, I mean, you don't really notice it. You don't notice how dominant he is sometimes. And it's kind of scary because he's so young. But he has a good handle about, you know, where he needs to be on the floor, and he's always impacting the game. And it seems like it's in small ways, but you look back on the game, and you should remember how much he was actually doing. Like, holy crap, this guy just put together a really complete game.
And I don't know if you were getting ready for your little tricycle promo or not, but we've got 10 minutes of Onuwaku, and we got 10 minutes of Jeff Withey today. I mean, Jeff Withey's time was in garbage time, literally the last 10 minutes of the game when it was already decided. But if I were to tell you that one of those guys gets, I don't know, 400 or 500 minutes this season, which one would you bank on, or which one would be the one that you would prefer to get those minutes just based on what you've seen?
It depends on if you're asking me with this current personnel, which I think that's kind of what your question is geared to. But I think Unuaku gives us something that Withey doesn't. I think that I think you can get that with plenty of other bigs on our roster. So I kind of want to say Unuaku, but in reality, if I was drafting, I would probably take Withey first.
So what is it that you see on Unuaku that gives us something different? Is it just his size, his bulk?
Yeah, I didn't see – I don't really remember a whole lot of great things that he did tonight. Not that he played terribly or anything. I know he had a bad screen, and I think he tried to post up Perel Antich. He looked really good tonight, and Perel Antich pulled a chair on him. It looked really, pretty bad, but he's okay. It's just that he's just a huge guy, and I just don't. You know, Steensma can get back down in the paint. Jason Smith is, you know, not exactly a, you know, rotund guy either. And Onuwaku is just a big guy. I mean, he must be like 270 or 280. And I don't think – there's nothing against those other guys. It's just they're not really equipped to deal with the hulking guys that, you know, you see every few nights in the NBA. And by every few nights, I mean occasionally.
So my last question for you, I mean, you obviously had – a great fan experience today. Some of our listeners have never got, you know, to be chosen. I mean, normally it's a 1 in 18,000 proposition to be brought down at halftime. Today it was about a 1 in 4 proposition with the amount of people that were in Biloxi.
Wait, are you saying there was 4 people there?
There was at least 4. It might have been 5 or 6.
Yeah, let's put it this way. It was a 30-point game, but nobody was leaving early because you normally do that to beat the traffic. This was not necessary in this game. But take us kind of through something that, you know, people have been to hundreds of basketball games might not have yet experienced. What happened today with you getting chose for the promo? What was it, and how did it go down?
Okay, so they had the tricycle race is what it was, and so I was upstairs with Jason. We were just kind of looking around. This is before the game had even started, and one of the Pelicans people approached me and said, you know, you're wearing tennis shoes. Would you like to be in something? And I guess that was a sole qualification, but for whatever reason, it chose me, and I said, yeah. And I thought maybe I'd get a gift card out of it or whatever. And so, you know, at the third quarter came around, and I went downstairs. I had some chicken tenders in me for fuel. And then, so the lady, she gets me set up and everything like that. And I'm waiting to see my opponents. I go down to see my opponents, and it's 2 middle-aged women. So the first thought that comes to my mind is, you know, I just hit the jackpot. You know, I'm just gonna ride right by these ladies, and then I'm going to get my prize or whatever. And then the second thought that came to my mind is, oh, my God, what if I lose? So we get out there, and it's just like this nightmare unfolding right in front of my eyes. We start to pedal, and the wheel just wouldn't go at all. I mean, so I was just pedaling furiously, and the thing was just not moving. I wasn't moving at all. And all of a sudden, I see these 2 women just go right by me, and we were riding around a circle, and it was 2 laps. And by the time one of them had finished the first lap, I must have gone about like 6 or 7 feet. So I mean, they're just blowing by me, and I finally got together, and I had some I've been watching some speed skating, so I know how to, you know, hug those corners. So I was doing that, but it wasn't even close. They just completely destroyed me, and you know, it's probably one of the most embarrassing things. I just tried to walk out of there and not make eye contact with anybody, but you know, I'm sure everybody got a good laugh out of it.
What you needed to do is, when they went by you, fall over and scream like they pushed you or something.
Yeah, foul play. Yeah, I didn't really know what to do. I just froze in the headlights. So.
And they could have called you Vince Carter. All right, Michael, so thanks for coming on and telling us all about the game. And hopefully we'll all be seeing games pretty soon here. I think the first one that actually has some sort of televised broadcast is what, the next, not the next one, but the one after. So
okay.
It'll be nice. Thanks, Michael.
All right, thanks, guys.
So I really was kind of half expecting him to like have fallen off a tricycle or something. So I'm a little upset. Like he didn't have like some, you know, bad ankle injury or something. I was hoping for like some blood and mayhem. How about you?
See, I think he took it far too well. For me, I would be in full conspiracy theory mode. Like, who set me up?
There's a ringer.
Why did I get this tricycle? Like, somebody made me out to look like a fool. Or those 2 middle-aged women just, you know, did something to the bikes in the back. Who had access to the bikes? I mean, I would be in full conspiracy mode. You wouldn't be able to get away with it that easy with me if I got that crappy bike and these 2 women just left me. I would be spending all of my resources to go into an investigation right now.
It'd be like one of those WWE moments. You'd have picked up the bike and smashed into the back of the MC's head.
I'm not a very gracious loser, I'll tell you that right now.
So Yeah. So here's the one thing I want to say about this game. Again, we already said we didn't get to see the stupid game. One thing just comes to, when I'm looking at the Hawks box score, it's not even like, you know, who scored, who did what. Cause like you look at Kyle Korver and there's not very often that Kyle Korver is going to go 0 of 6 from 3. And you're not going to have Jeff Teague go 1 of 8. Now, our defense probably had something to do with it, but it's just fact that's not going to happen very often. But I had always gotten like this feeling about the Hawks that they lost players this summer, but they pretty much recovered and had replaced them. That's not really accurate. That's only true if you're thinking big pieces. Like, Josh Smith left, so they brought in Paul Millsap. And, you know, in my opinion, Paul Millsap's a little bit worse of a player, but not much worse. And they kept Kyle Korver, and they managed to re-sign Jeff Teague. They still got, you know, Lou Williams. They brought in Gustavo Ayon, who everybody knows I'm fond of. They got Elton Brand in. So I feel like they had managed to reload this team. But it's a really bad team after the first three or four players. I mean, they've lost Zaza Pachulia, who, you know, people make fun of him because his name is Zaza. But he's actually a really, really good third big man. They lost Ivan Johnson, who's like your favorite person in the world. They don't have Devin Harris, who isn't particularly efficient, but he can soak up a lot of minutes and score fairly well. They don't have Deshaun Stevenson anymore. Anthony Tolliver has turned into a decent rotation player. They used to have Morrow for 41 games. I mean, this team has let all those guys go and replaced them with diddly. I don't think Atlanta is a threat to be, well, I mean, I guess it's the Eastern Conference. So, 8 seed, yeah, they could be a threat to be an 8 seed.
Yeah, see, I don't know. I think there's 5 guys who are in their rotation and who didn't play in this game. I know, and I talked to my friend, which I'll tell you a couple things he said about us later on in the game, my friend who works for the Hawks. I know that they love John Jenkins, their first-round pick from last year out of Vanderbilt, one of the best three-point shooters, if not the best, in the NCAA 2 years ago. He'll be in their rotation. Lou Williams will be in their rotation. Damari Carroll, which, you know, you want to talk about guys that I love. You know, he's one of those guys. Gustavo Ayon missed a couple weeks, but he'll be in the rotation. And like you said, Lou Williams, he'll be their sixth man, if not sometimes, part-time starter. So I think 5 guys from their regular rotation were not playing in this game. You add Elton Brand, and then their 4 starters, Kyle Korver, Jeff Teague, Al Horford, and Paul Millsap. I don't know. I think that's 10 strong in the Eastern Conference. I expect them to be a playoff team if John Jenkins could be another guy who spaces the floor for them. I like them better than, say, somebody like Detroit, who everybody's all, you know, excited about. And I think the Shoney projection had at 5th in the East this week, which I just, my mind was blown by that.
Yeah. I don't know. I just look at this team and nobody on this team strikes fear in my heart. Like, I really like Al Horford as a player. I would trade a lot of pieces on our team to get Al Horford on our squad. But he doesn't strike, I mean, he's not like a guy who's going to take over a game and destroy you. He's the guy who's going to do all the little dirty things. He's like he could be a second best player on a pretty solid team, doing all the rebounding, scoring here and there, defending their best big man. But there isn't anybody on this team that I'm like, oh no, please don't let him shoot.
Yeah, but I mean, at the end of the day, I think 37, 38 wins could make the playoffs in the East. Do I think it's possible that the Hawks could do that? Yeah, I definitely do.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I stopped myself when I was about to say, they're not even a playoff contender. And I was like, yeah, right. Like, we have people talking about how Toronto almost made the playoffs last year. Yeah, with 33 wins.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, from this game, I think the thing, as you could tell, the first question I asked Pelichet, I'm most excited about is, you know, I didn't even put this in my if column a couple weeks back because, honestly, I just didn't think it was possible. I didn't think that Aminu could be even an average jump shooter because I essentially think we know who guys are 2-3 years into the league. They might improve from awful to bad or from average to slightly above average, but you know, in certain categories, but they don't make huge leaps after we've seen them for a couple years. I would put Aminu's jump shot as awful in regards to his position, the small forward position in the NFL. I would put it at awful. If it could even be average, and in this game it was, you know, above average, but if it could even be average throughout the course of a season where teams have to respect it, I just don't know how many things would have a bigger impact for the Pelicans than Aminu having to be respected in the half court.
Yeah. So, I mean, here's the thing about Aminu. It feels like Aminu's been in the league forever and that we know exactly what he is. But there is still the reality that every single study out there says that age 24 to 25 is where players actually have their biggest seasons, have their breakout seasons. If you have a player who's been in the league for multiple years, age 23 is usually a good place for them to be making their first small leap, but the real leap doesn't happen at 24, 25. So it is possible that Aminu, who is 23, is going to make a leap this year.
Yeah.
I agree with you. I would be shocked if it was jump shooting, but it's possible.
Yeah, it would really have to be the rebounding. He's already elite for his position. He is never going to be a good passer. There are some. I remember Trevor Ariza coming into the league. I don't know if he was as bad, but it was in that area. And the year that basically he made all that money, the Lakers don't win the finals without him, you know, becoming a three-point shooter that could space the floor and you know, provide a legitimate threat. So, I guess it's possible. I just thought the shot was so awful. He wasn't only missing last year. His shot just looked different than every other NBA player in the league. I couldn't imagine that it could be respectable and, you know, quite frankly, I don't know if people know this, but I do almost all of my projections off of NBA 2K. It's the truth. I know in my articles, I try to seem like I do all this research. Really, it's all about NBA 2K, and I've really been having a lot of problems spacing the floor with that starting lineup because, you know, teams just sag off of Aminu, and I can't do anything about it. And, I was really scared because of that. But if he could provide, like I said, even just an average jump shot, something that teams have to respect, it's just going to do so much for this starting offensive lineup that, you know, is probably going to have Steemsma on it. And like I said in the last podcast, you just can't have two black holes.
Yeah, don't get carried away, though.
I mean,
I still don't expect it. I mean, he can have one good game. Yeah, I don't expect to see it happen.
I don't expect them to drain four every game, but again, it's not so much about how many he makes, but you know the fact that teams will have to respect it. To me, that's way more important. And if he can make enough to make teams at least respect it, I mean, a foot in basketball, a guy being a foot further out on Aminu, you know, provides that much extra spacing and the half of a second more that it takes for him to get over. I mean, a foot, 2 feet in basketball could be a world of difference when guys are this big and this fast. So just the threat of it would be enough where teams can't play 8 feet off of him.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, I kind of expected Aminu's leap would be more of a defensive one. Like, we always talk about how he's got those amazing tools, but he's always also got those lapses where he's just not in the right place. I kind of assumed that once he was getting a little older, he's going to have more of that focus necessary to be able to stay in the right place and always be in the right place and be able to help at the right times. So I was kind of hoping for that. But you're right. If he manages to knock down, you know, 2 out of every 5 jumpers, it's not bad. That'll help.
Yeah.
Because right now it's like 1 out of every 5.
And then Austin Rivers, not the greatest game from the field, 3 for 10, but 80% on his free throws, 4 out of 5. And I remember your big concern, you know, among many concerns, but your biggest were that, you know, things like steals, rebounds are indicators of athleticism and, you know, you didn't see much of that coming from Austin Rivers in college. In this game, he really filled out the box sheet. He had those 10 points, but also had 5 assists, 4 steals, 4 rebounds. Austin's getting a lot of minutes in the preseason right now that we don't expect him to get in the regular season. Overall, I know you haven't seen much of him play, but we have some with summer league and then the box scores of preseason. You know, your thoughts on Austin and what to expect this year.
So far my expectations have raised from Austin from being a negative to a replacement player, maybe better. So I no longer think he's going to go out there and cost us games. But I'm still not convinced he's going to be much better than overall a player that you could pull out of the D League. I got to actually see him be able to do this when it really matters. Because you got to take this with a grain of salt. We're talking about Austin Rivers not having the greatest game in the world. And remember, he went up against 16 minutes of Jeff Teague, Damian Wilkins, Kyle Korver, Shelvin Mack, Royal Ivy. This is the murderer's row of guards that he faced. None of them are guys who are, you know, are even moderately impressive. Like Jeff Teague is I think we had this conversation, like maybe 13th best in the league, 14th best point guard. This isn't even like a top 10 guy. So I have to wait and see him go against real guards and see if he can keep pulling this off before I jump on the Rivers bandwagon.
Are you?
It would be nice if there is an actual Rivers bandwagon at some point this season. I mean, this season will have been going wonderfully for us.
Yeah, I mean, so maybe not. You're not so sure that he can be very good this year. Are you at least a little less afraid that he's a bust than you were, let's say, January of last season?
Yeah, I mean, it was hard to get past what the actual numbers were telling you from last season. But I also think I remember saying that I'm not really going to worry about him being a bust until midway through this season. So if we get to the middle of this season and he's as bad as he was last season, then I think he's probably going to be bust land. But it already looks like he's probably not going to be there. So I'm feeling a little better. I'm still not convinced that he's going to be a solid rotation player. Hopefully I'm wrong.
So before this game, we had another game this week that, again, didn't get to see. All we could really do is look at the box score and piece together some tweets, articles, et cetera, from people who were there.
Watch the play-by-play go by.
Yeah, I mean, I'm such a loser. I watched the little the ESPN game tracker or whatever they call it, and you know, you're watching basically a rendering of the basketball court and then a little basketball the size of like 6 pixels gets shot from the spot it was shot on the court. And like you're actually watching it because it doesn't tell you if it went in or not. It'll just show you the arc of the shot going towards the rim and you have that half a second of anticipation and then either it goes in or not. Like, gosh, yeah. What a loser to be watching. I mean, to tell you the truth, but I mean, what we did get is the theme of Anthony Davis at nearly a point per minute continues. 29 points in 31 minutes in this game, including a stretch in the third quarter where he just took over 11 for 11 from the free throw line, had 4 blocks, 9 rebounds. I remember you asking me, I think in the last podcast, if I was worried about the Anthony Davis rebounding, and I believe he's had 9 in the 2 games since then, yeah, and averaging about 28 minutes a game. Just, I mean, from all that we could tell from the people who were there in the stats, another amazing game for Davis. I mean, the articles that you wrote and the things that I said going into the year about how this guy is going to take the next step, have we possibly even undersold? Is there a chance he's a top 8 player in the league this year, at the end of the year?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, one of the things that I'm working on that should come out next week sometime is an evaluation of all of the big men and their second years in the season and what kind of leap they actually made. I had my original post where I talked about Anthony Davis and you know, Kevin Garnett and them. I had some of them, but this is like an evaluation of like other big men as well and how big of a jump they made. And there are strong indicators that, you know, when you and I said we thought he might lead the team in scoring and we were guessing like, you know, 18 or 17, there's a really good chance that he'll be playing 35, 36 minutes a game and putting down 22 to 24 points. And, I mean, that's vastly underselling what we saw and seen in preseason basketball so far. I mean, he's only touched 31 minutes once, and he's been – I mean, I think he's averaging 26 at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy what he's doing.
It's insane. And, I mean, you could argue both ways. You could say that when Gordon and Evans play, that'll take away shots from him and reduce the scoring. Or you could say it'll give him even more space to operate, more, you know, put back dunks and layups with those guys driving and bringing 2-3 defenders with him. And he might even, you know, be more efficient or score more when those guys return. So, I guess one thing, you know, that's for sure, though, is that Monty has completely let him go. And I think that when you talk about what was stopping Anthony Davis last year, you would probably list injuries number one, and then you'd probably put Monty Williams at number two. There was even a time when Anthony Davis's dad was a little frustrated with the amount of time that he was getting, and Monty has basically said he's taking the reins off, going to let the kid go, probably looking at 35 to 38 minutes, maybe even more on a night where the game's really close, and he needs them to win. So, you know, I don't even know if you could project looking at last year's numbers, because I think it's going to be so different the way he's used and the way that Monty just you know, doesn't look at him as a teenage boy anymore. He's playing him like he would any other veteran NBA player.
Yeah, I can't. I mean, I'm so excited to see him play this year. I cannot wait. The question I have, though, about that previous game, Jrue Holiday takes 8 shots in 27 minutes. He has actually been taking, on average, about 10 shots a game. He had that one game he took 14. But other than that, he's been right around 10. This is a guy who was an all-star last year. He had a usage rate of, I think, 27%. He took like 16 shots a game. I'm loving the fact that he's willing to, I mean, and yeah, so I should say he is only playing 24 minutes, but I'm still loving the fact that he has clearly reduced the number of shots he's taking. And did you expect that Holiday would do that, or did you think he was still going to be trying to be the man and score more often?
No, I think he actually loved that. I think a season like last year for Holiday was needed. And, you know, I keep going back. I don't know why this comment of yours is just stuck in my head, but from a podcast a couple of months ago where you said that basically the Pelicans have three top guards from three bad teams. So the top guard from three bad teams from last year. And, you know, I think going through that is something that will really help Jrue Holiday out long-term and probably even Gordon and Tyreek. They have seen that when they are the lead guards on bad teams and they get as many shots as they want, that their teams just simply don't win. And now you have Evans, who's more than willing to, even though he's getting paid $11 million a year, to come off the bench. You have Drew Holiday, who early returns say, you know, he's going to limit his shot attempts and look to get others the ball. And Eric Gordon, who seems to be buying in as well. I think the fact that those guys all were these lead dogs on really bad teams kind of humbled them to a point and made them realize that, you know, if they're taking a lot of shots, their team's probably losing. So I fully expect Drew Holiday, you know, I know people have thought his points per game could go up. I expect both numbers to drop, honestly. I expect both the points per game and the assists per game to drop for Holiday from last year, but I expect him to be a better NBA player.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, prediction-wise, I'm thinking of Holiday in like a 14-8 kind of way. And honestly, you know, we've had Chris Paul. We watched how great Chris Paul was. We watched one of the best point guard seasons ever when he rattled off like a 21-11. But the one thing everybody always said about those Chris Paul teams and Chris Paul being on the front end of that team was we were so predictable. And you knew Chris Paul was going to go into pick and roll. And he knew you knew he was going to pick and roll. And he was still going to tear you apart and probably score on you. But everybody knew what was happening. And every team could load up and figure out, you know, how they wanted to defend it. Were they going to stick on Peja? Were they going to try to jam Tyson? Were they going to just take David West out of the equation? Or were they going to let Paul and West operate and worry about everybody else? They always had, like, some sort of thing they could do to stop what you were doing. And this team right now, how do you account for three different creative weapons when they have Ryan Anderson on the wing and Anthony Davis, who already has shown that he can impact scoring-wise a lot of different things just by the way he always keeps moving. And people, like, give guys lots of credit for when they're always moving without the ball. And Davis, he's so big. He covers so much ground so fast. You don't notice, like, him being in frenetic motion and your eyes aren't drawn to him. Like, he's frantically moving here and there. It's not like a Psycho T kind of thing where Hansbrough is, like, vibrating while he's trying to move around the screen, so your eye can't but help be drawn to the weird freak jumping around out there doing all his energy stuff. And Davis is just as good at that kind of thing because he's just so smooth and long. I mean, this is going to be a crazy team to stop. You throw two guys at Drew Holiday and at Eric Gordon, and we still have three people who are going to score on you.
Yeah, and I mean, again, we got to preface all that with when healthy, which hopefully the Pelicans.
Oh, you're such a Debbie Downer.
No, I mean, but
come on, we've seen Eric Gordon play a lot this year.
Yeah, and Tyreek. I mean, I just think I completely agree. Dell Demps could only construct a team. After that, you know, it's kind of out of his hands. I think he has constructed an offensive juggernaut once, you know, they learn each other's game, have some time to gel, figure out roles, you know, see what plays work and which don't. And I think the team has the potential to be just as good defensively. I mean, with their length, like I said, the Anthony Davis, Drew Holiday, if you're setting a pick on Drew Holiday with Anthony Davis's man, good luck to that point guard who now, as the Pelicans hedge or even trap, I just have no idea how that point guard is going to make any kind of play with all that length there, say, you know, and then you got Aminu kind of on the weak side or somewhere lurking with his long arms to deflect any kind of pass. I just think that the team that he constructed you know, is absolutely fantastic, but it's going to be on that if they stay healthy, you know, that's always going to be the big question. And going back to Holiday, I think he's really going to embrace the role, and I think it's going to be one of those things where it's just about who has the mismatch that night. So there might be nights where Holiday gives you 6 and 6 because, you know, one of the elite point guards defensively is hounding him. I think we play Phoenix twice in the first couple weeks. And if Eric Bledsoe's on him, but then Gordon and Tyreek have Goran Dragic on them, you know, that's their day to go to work. And I think it could kind of rotate like that. And it seems like all of those guys are willing to kind of go, you know, have their numbers shrink a little bit for the greater good.
Yeah. So let's bring up another player who we haven't talked a lot about. We talked a lot about him last year. He's gone through some horrible stuff this offseason. Ryan Anderson. Do you think he's going to be impacted by what happened on the court?
I mean, this is the thing. First of all, I feel so unqualified to really talk about. I mean, I did go to a master. I have gotten master's degree in school counseling. I do understand some things about human psychology, but the more you understand about it, the more you know that it's completely unpredictable. I mean, I remember Willie Green, his sister dying right in the middle of the season in a pretty terrible way. He took a couple days off and came back and, you know, played pretty well. David Wesley, you know, who's now one of the Pelicans announcers, great friends with Bobby Fills. Bobby Fills dies on the way home from a practice right in front of David Wesley and didn't affect him that much on the court. Michael Jordan has his father die, and he basically takes away a year and a half from the game of basketball. And I don't know if that was the number one reason, but it was definitely one of the top ones, and most would say it was the number one reason. So, I mean, to think that this is universal, I've seen a lot of people say, well, if this happened to me, the last thing I could do is concentrate on basketball. I've seen other people say, if it happened to me, I would focus more on basketball to get away from it. It's so unique to the person if I were to have to guess, from the interviews I've seen of Ryan Anderson since the incident, which, man, are just so tough to watch. It seems like he really, he really has a different outlook than most people, on this. It seems like he truly believes that everything happens from a reason and a lot of good could come out of this. I don't know if I would have the strength to believe the same thing if this happened to me, but it seems like he does. And it seems like Monty and all the guys on the team are a huge support system for him. And, you know, it's probably better for him to be on the team right now than, you know, somewhere else. Do I think that when there's 6 minutes to go in the third quarter of a game and he spots up for a three that, you know, what happened this summer will have any effect on if that shot goes in or not? No, but could it have an effect on, you know, the amount of concentration he puts into a practice, or, you know, if on a Saturday he goes to the gym and just hoists up 500 extra three-point shots, or, you know, if he's somewhere else because of this incident? I mean, that's where it could have some effect, is probably on the day-to-day stuff outside of the on-court, and then how does that day-to-day stuff just affect his, you know, his building or, you know, building of his skill. But, you know, I just think it's the biggest variable on this team, because there's absolutely no way to predict it.
Yeah. Yeah, there's been a lot written about Ryan Anderson, especially, and you mentioned it, the whole Ryan Anderson, Anthony Davis, can they work together kind of thing. His numbers, I mean, he had his worst true shooting percentage last year since his rookie season. So there's some questions about whether he's going to fit on this team. I kind of expect a pretty big season from Ryan Anderson, but you're right. I mean, there's no way to tell what this off-court stuff can mean. There's an awesome article I read about one of the beat writers who followed the Houston Rockets, and this is a completely different flavor of things, but just off-court impacting on-court, Tracy McGrady, who apparently used to sleep 11 hours every day when there was a game day, had a kid, and suddenly he wasn't getting that sleep, and that was the first year he started falling apart. And that he wasn't going to practices the way he was. His sleep patterns were interrupted. He wasn't working as hard. He wasn't working out. He started getting back issues. And that was the general downhill slope of Tracy McGrady. So off-court things can be really impactful. Let's just hope Ryan Anderson can work his way through this. Seems kind of petty for me to say that about basketball, though. But, you know.
Yeah, I mean, in the larger scheme, I really believe that almost any Pelican fan, and I would like to believe any Pelican fan, if given the choice between Ryan Anderson and having a happy, healthy life, but, you know, not being a good basketball player, or being a good basketball player and having these demons for the rest of his life and being sad, hopefully we would all choose, you know, the world where Ryan Anderson is happy and mentally okay, even though it hurts the team. But, you know, it is something that, you know, is legitimate to talk about when we're talking about this season. I mean, yeah, off the field, off the court, whatever you want to call it, stuff could have, you know, huge impact. But to be fair, there's 14 other guys on this team. We have no idea. I mean, there could be off-court stuff affecting them right now. I mean, I think back to Dirk's incident a couple of years ago with, you know, some kind of escort, or I don't remember if she was a dancer or whatever. It was some kind of weird story where she was suing him for, I don't even remember what it was.
Yeah, it was his fiancée, and she was like a 38-year-old former stripper.
Yeah, and
it's just weird. How does that happen? What?
I don't know. Something weird was going, but I mean, you know, these are adults just like anybody else, and they all could be having some sort of off-court problem. We just don't know about it. And yes, psychology definitely comes into the game, but, you know, from the little that we've seen, you know, it looks like his shot is about the same. It's still pretty streaky. He's had a couple games where, you know, he's exploded for 8 or 10 points in a very small stretch of time, and then, you know, not much around that. It seems like, and Monty even spoke to this, that he wants to get him around the basket more on the offensive end for, you know, for offensive rebounds. And, you know, Anderson has been getting more 2-point buckets than usual this preseason and getting to the line at a pretty good rate. So, you know, I guess, you know, until I see otherwise, I'm going to expect the same Ryan Anderson we've seen for the last 2 years. And, you know, really it's going to be, the question is, will the fact that there's better perimeter defenders on the court, you know, help the Ryan Anderson, Anthony Davis duo defensively? Because the numbers were awful last year on the defensive end, but to be fair, you know, you had some of the worst ball stoppers and defensive perimeter players I've ever seen on the court with those guys. If you have Drew Holiday, if you have Tyreek and Eric Gordon out there able to stop penetration, able to rotate better and faster, you know, will they be able to perform better defensively? And I think as well as they do on that end will result in how much they get to play together, because I don't think there's any question about the offensive end. Those two are almost perfectly built for each other, and those two next to guys like Tyreek and Drew and Gordon just open up the floor immensely for them. It's all going to be, you know, are they decent enough defensively to warrant them playing together so the Pelicans get that offensive production?
Okay. So you got any other things you wanted to talk about?
Reached out to Twitter followers and readers from the site, asked for some questions.
Twitter.
On Twitter. Some questions of theirs. So I want to get meta first. So I'm going to ask you a question about the questions. So okay. I'm looking over all of them now. Give me in order the top three Pelicans that I got questions about.
I bet you got questions about Tyreke Evans. Wait, so the order of most questions to least?
Most questions to least, top three.
All right. I would say Holiday's first, then Jeff Withey second, and Evans third.
You actually nailed none of the top three.
I guess I'm not in touch with
him. Speaking of Jeff Withey, I did get two on him, but neither was spelled close to correctly. So just want to, for Pelicans fans, work on spelling his name. I see a lot of Whitey or Whiteley. So
could be autocorrect.
Yeah, Withey, Onowaku is a guy that, it took me a little while. It wasn't natural, his first or last name, to spell. Now I feel like I could do it. Steemsma, for some reason, I always want to do E before I, even though I know it's, the rule is I before E. But some new names to learn how to spell. But when you misspell Withey, it just always looks the weirdest, because somehow it turns into Whitey or Whiteley or just...
Which is moderately amusing.
But no, number one is Brian Roberts by a wide margin.
Okay.
Like far and away the number one. And it's this question about, almost all of them are around the same stratosphere. Do we see him having a role this year? If so, what's the role? I got, a question on who gets the backup point guard minutes, him or Rivers. And then, obviously from there leading to trade, do we look to trade him? If so, for what? But first, let's assume he's on the team. I mean, when I did my rotation piece a couple of weeks ago, I basically said that if healthy, I don't see in a normal, game, of course you'll have games where, it's a blowout one way or the other, or a specific matchup or guys are hurt. But in a normal game, I didn't have him getting 1 minute. Do you think he has a spot in the regular rotation? Do you expect him to get consistent minutes if he's on this team?
I expect him to get absolutely 0 minutes when he's on this team. I think you nailed the rotations almost head on. I mean, let's be realistic about Brian Roberts. The guy is a shooting guard in a point guard's body. He has defensive issues. He can get extremely hot and hit a bunch of shots and bring you back into the game. But you don't want to have to be relying on him every single game in and out to try to do that for you. You want him to be like your, well, nobody's hitting anything, so let's find the next guy who maybe is going to try and bring us back. And that role is the fifth guard on a team. It's not fourth guard who's getting rotation minutes. It's the guy who's just like, Austin Rivers is one of eight. Tyreke Evans is one of nine. And Eric Gordon has, tripped over his own feet and gotten his pinky boo-boo. So we got to throw another guard out there to see if he can score something. And, I mean, you got to have a fifth guard in the NBA. Is Brian Roberts probably better than most fifth guards in the NBA? Yes. But it's not like he's 40% better than most of them. He's a little bit better. So you trade him and what? You get the fifth best big man from somebody else? I just hold on to him and use him and hope that, he helps you win a couple games over the course of the season and provides valuable backup minutes if we continue to have injury bugs.
Yeah, I think one thing I want to hit on that you said that was 100% is that Brian Roberts is a shooting guard. There was a stretch in this Hawks game where Brian Roberts was the only, ball handler on the floor. It was, essentially him, Anthony Morrow. So he was the only ball handler. And the Pelicans offense just came to a grinding halt. It was awful. according to the shot chart, saw Roberts hoisting up jumpers and, had turnovers at that point. Then Drew Holiday comes in, and magically Roberts starts getting some assists. He had according to people who were there, a gorgeous lob to Anthony Davis for a dunk. I think he is a shooting guard. I think he's a guy off the ball that either shoots or breaks down a defense after the defense has already been broken down and swung to him. Then he can make plays work. But if he's going to be your offensive initiator and he's pounding the ball at the top of the 3-point arc, you're in trouble. So yes, he is a shooting guard. And, I agree mostly with your point that it's not horrible to have a luxury. I mean, that's what good teams have is they have enough depth to have a little bit of luxury at a position. I was looking at the Grizzlies roster today, and they have probably four small forwards that should be playing in this league. And okay, what's the harm in that? You got depth and it's a long season. So, I could see him being here, but I really don't see him having a role.
Right. And well, I mean, just take the Spurs. They have Tony Parker and Manu Ginobili. They had Danny Green, Gary Neal, Patty Mills, Corey Joseph, and Nando DiColo all on their team. And sometimes you would see the Spurs as only Patty Mills would be on the court playing, 10 minutes in a game because he's the one who's helping them out that game. And next time you look, it's Corey Joseph doing it. Those guys did not play a lot of minutes. They didn't even play, Corey Joseph didn't even play a third of the season. But those guys do matter, and it helped the Spurs be able to be as good of a team as they were in the regular season. So I don't know. I personally think just hold on to Brian Roberts, and if somebody comes along and says we're looking to move a decent big, and Anuaku isn't working out and Withy isn't ready, I see if Brian Roberts is good enough for them. I just don't see them. I mean, what is the difference really? If you look around the league, do you think the difference between Brian Roberts and Gennaro Pargo? And talent, like the old Gennaro Pargo, the one who was actually on our team when it was good, is.
See, I don't know, because my perception, maybe I'm a little bit more skeptical, but I was sitting next to some Clippers people in preseason, at Summer League when I was there, and they were firmly in the belief that, Brian Roberts could be a starter on some NBA teams.
What?
I mean, other people, it's one of those things where you only see a player a couple of times, depending on when you saw him, you could fall in love with them. So I really don't know what the perception is, but I do want to temper the trade talk with this. So again, back to the constant theme of this podcast, apparently, that I'm just a giant loser. My wife went out of town for 5 days. She's still gone. And, did I use this opportunity to meet up with old friends, go out to bars for the first time in a while, really, live a free bachelor life again? No, I did not. I stayed at home, played NBA 2K, and browsed the Hoops Hype salaries column. Basically, it's almost impossible to trade Brian Roberts. I mean, first of all, there are guys – so there's virtual untradeables on the Pelicans roster. And then there's, the other guys that you're not just trading to get something for Brian Roberts. Like, you're not looking to move Brian Roberts and then going, well, if I add Ryan Anderson to this deal, I could get, if you're going to move Ryan Anderson, it's for a Ryan Anderson purpose, not for, to see what you could get for Brian Roberts. So you take the big five off the list as far as guys that you could package in a trade with Roberts. Then you also have to eliminate Aminu, Steemsma, Anthony Morrow, and I don't know if I'm missing anybody, Anuaku, Lance Thomas. like all those guys, because they were just signed. So you can't trade them till like December. And even then, because they're on 1 year deals, you talked about this with Kuhn a little bit, they have what essentially is a, you know, a veto clause where they could veto trade. So now you're really looking at two options. You're looking at, you could move Brian Roberts for a guy that makes up to, you know, at maximum $1.2 million, which you're not going to find anybody worthwhile in there. Or in order to package him and get somebody who makes a decent salary, your only real option is to package him with Austin Rivers. And are you moving now? Are you moving Austin Rivers and Roberts just to get, you know, a marginal $4 million center like Ekpe Udoh? Of course you're not. So really, if you're looking to move Roberts, you've got to look for past second round picks, because honestly, those are the only guys making, you know, in that salary range. I just really don't see it as a possibility. I still think the only possible one is Kyle Singler. I think another viable option is, what would you do if Utah came to you and offered their second round pick in the 2014 draft? They just lost Trey Burke, who broke his thumb, I believe. If they come to you and they say, you know, we'll give you our 2014 second rounder, supposedly a good draft. You would think their second rounder is going to be top eight in the second round. And then maybe you could bring in Pierre Jackson to be your fifth guard. Would you make a move like that? That's like the only thing I could really consider.
Yeah, I mean, I would do that. But, you know, none of this is going to move the needle. So it's like, I think if Dell Demps is tossing and turning, trying to figure out ways to turn Brian Roberts into something, I'd be pretty shocked.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just more, I just want Pelicans fans to have some idea about how few trades or moves are coming down the pike over this next. I mean,
right.
I mean, for different reasons, there is literally nobody movable on this roster.
Yeah.
I mean, I if I were to guess, if we see a different player on this Pelicans roster this season, it'll be because in March, when somebody got waived or bought out because they got traded to a bad team as filler and they got waived. I mean, we see this every year. We've seen the PJ Browns. We've seen, I mean, every year in March, a couple of guys who could still play, you know, are waived or bought out and are signed by teams that are, you know, making the playoffs or in a playoff run. That's the only way, you know, I could really see the Pelicans add in somebody is if somebody like that gets waived and agrees to come here in March. Other than that, I really don't see any roster changes. I looked through all 29 teams. The only trades I could possibly think of for Roberts would be Singler. There's a couple of teams who have, you know, some second round picks that are stashed with Dell. You know, Dell scouts all those guys, knows them better than I do. Would he trade Roberts for a guy who's stashed right now? You know, or like I said, a second round pick from a team like Utah that has a point guard go down with injury and wants to bring in somebody like Roberts. Other than that, it's almost impossible because of the rules of, you know, of what you have to do or what rules you have to abide by to be able to trade players in this CBA.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was actually kind of thinking along the same lines. After we had that conversation about would you trade him for Udoh, like how could Dell, not even like with Brian Roberts just aside, not even to think about Brian Roberts, but how could Dell acquire a big man who actually maybe could move the needle a little bit? And I had the same thoughts. Like, there isn't a lot of ways to trade stuff on this team. You don't want to be trading Rivers and them yet, because you need to figure out how that guard rotation works all together. You don't want to be trading any really big pieces until you figure that out. You don't want to be trading, you know, obviously Jason Smith or maybe Steensma, because those guys are part of your big rotation, which is already a little thin, and that's what you're trying to build up on. And I was thinking, you know, well, you know, it's Demps. Maybe he'll take a flyer on a big from overseas. But even the reality there isn't that likely because the European market has changed. You don't go to Europe anymore and sign a guy for Jack Diddley and bring him over and have him play. The guys who are good enough in Europe to come over and possibly have an impact in the NBA, who, you know, will be in a rotation, those guys are making a couple million dollars a year in Europe. And we can't pay that much. The Pelicans are over the salary cap, so they can't bring over those guys. So really the only ways, you know, we could see Onuwaku, if he doesn't work out, turn into a usable player is if they strike gold in the D League with a different guy, which, I mean, that does not happen very often.
Yeah, if there's a big guy in the D League that could play, he'd be in the NBA. I mean, it's just that simple. Right. They'll do anything for bigs. I mean, I know Daniel Orton just came available. You know, maybe he's somebody you go after, but I don't expect much change. I mean, theoretically, maybe you could go the other way, and this is getting way too ahead of ourselves, but if a guy like Greg Monroe becomes available, maybe you look at moving Rhino for him and Brian Roberts as sweetener in that case. You know, something like that. Al Horford, you know, again, that's a guy that I would give up somebody like Ryan Anderson for, if it came down to it. So, you know, in cases like that, maybe Roberts gets traded, but as far as, well, he's too good to be a fifth guard. I tend to agree slightly. I think he's probably a fourth guard in this league, you know, talent wise, but just go ahead, do it yourself. Go on Hoops Hype, try to find guys with salaries close to Roberts that, you know, the team would trade, because if they're good and they're close to Roberts, like Chandler Parsons, that trade's not happening. And, you know, if they're terrible second round picks, we don't want them anyway. So go ahead and try. Look through all the 29 teams like I did and, you know, see if you could find a partner. I really couldn't.
All right, that's too much time on Brian
Roberts.
Well,
number two, if you thought that was too much on Roberts, the number two player that I was tweeted, asked about, none other than Greg Steensma. My favorite comment comes from a guy, his name is just Joe. It's just Joe. And he says, in you know, basically in Monty's press conference the other day, Monty was quoted as saying, Steensma has done nothing to lose his starting job. Joe thinks that Monty should have just stopped after the word nothing. Steensma has done nothing and then just cut it off.
Oh.
I mean, the question around, I mean, it's, can Steensma get the job done as our number one center? What do you expect from Steensma? You know, what should we pursue, a center, or can Steensma, you know, hold the fort down? What would be a successful season for Steensma? Why is Monty starting Steensma in the first place? I mean, a lot of Steensma stuff. I guess that's my biggest thing, is there's no way he's going to be a great player, or even a good player. But what would Steensma have to do for you to consider it a successful season for a guy we gave $2.6 million to and is essentially, you know, a starter who's not really a starter?
I mean, he's got to be more of an impact on the boards, and really that's it. If his blocks will be fine, I'm sure, but if he can just help on the defensive boards, that is this team's number one need. And every single one of these preseason games, I believe, I'm pretty sure the first one was as well, the Pelicans were out-rebounded by the other team. You got to have somebody who can do some board work. Now, Steensma is not that guy. He's never been that guy. He's been, you know, a 12% rebounder, which is, you know, mediocre for a power forward and terrible for a center. So I don't know why you would think he could do that, but if that's what he could do, if he could just focus on the defensive boards and clean the defensive glass for the 15 minutes he's there, I'm 100% happy with him on the team. But I mean, the reality of what Steamsma is he's a placeholder. Like we've said this before, this season is a what do we have season. Anthony Davis is coming into his own. Is he a center? Is he a power forward? If he's a center, Steamsma, bye. We didn't spend a whole lot of money on Nick Petkovic this summer because what if Davis was a center? So you wouldn't need Petkovic then. And you have your slew of guards and other power forwards to figure out which ones fit. Once you figure out what fits, you send the other pieces out for new pieces, maybe a new center. Doesn't have to be a great center with Anthony Davis. Just has to be a center. And you're fine. So Steamsma is a placeholder. And, you know, if he sticks around next year, he'll be a backup, and he's fine as a backup big man. In my world, aspire to the lofty heights of an elite fifth big man, but he's a fifth big man.
Yeah, I mean, to me, first of all, I see no way Steamsma's on this team long term. I even hesitate to think that they'll bring him back as a backup, only because he's making $2.6 million this year, which means that you basically got to give him $3 million next year to come back. You're not going to reduce his salary, you know, just for pride issues. That's not going to happen, you know, with him. And if you're just looking for, you know, a backup big body next year, you probably go a little bit cheaper, spend that money elsewhere. You're going to have to pay Jason Smith theoretically next year, give him a new contract. I don't know if it'll be a huge raise, but it'll be something. So I don't think you're going to give Steamsma $3 million next year to be the fourth big. I think essentially what he is this year, his biggest role is he's the guy that, you know, whenever you see in the movies, they're kind of walking through the jungle very slowly. And then, you know, the one guy that you don't know the name of, you know, steps on the mine and you hear it click and, you know, everybody's kind of looking around. But first of all, there was a reason why he was the guy in front. Like, his life is not that valuable. And
wow,
we're willing to let him go. I think that's his biggest role as a Pelican this year is you do not want 80-pound guys banging on Anthony Davis over and over and over again for an 82-game season. So essentially, Steamsma is there to jump on that mine, you know, to trip the wire, whatever, take that beating so Anthony Davis doesn't have to this year. I really think that, you know, that's why he's going to start games when the opposing center is fresh, you know, when he's obviously out there. And then we're going to see Davis at center more often, you know, when the opposing center is out of the game. That's, you know, that would be my guess. But I think his biggest role this year is just to take the punishment so Davis doesn't have to. And for me, a successful season would be something like what we saw today in the Hawks game. You know, you look through the column and, oh, he only had 2 points and he had a couple of rebounds, not great, not terrible. But the fact that he had no turnovers, and I don't have it in front of me, but I want to say he only had like 2 personal fouls. To me, you know, that was a win. That's what I want. Just do not make the mistakes, you know, score on putbacks, or I think his one score in this game was pick and roll. The ball was passed to Anthony Davis. Obviously, they all swarmed to him, and Davis, it was either Davis or Aminu, just gave a little dump off pass to Steamsma for a layup under the basket. That's all I want. Just do not make any mistakes and step on the mine, you know, on the grenade for Anthony Davis.
Very nice. Very noble of you.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's something to be applauded.
It's a job.
Yeah, I really don't feel bad for the guy. The guy's making $2.6 million.
Right.
You know, he has a job that he likes. He is not one of the best in his league, but he is one of the top 500 to 700 people at this one thing in the entire world. That's, you know, that's admirable. I mean, that's great. I would like to be one of the top 700 people at anything in the world, other than getting large amounts of barbecue on my shirt even if I don't eat dinner that has anything to do with barbecue. So that is the second guy. The third one we've already talked to a lot, talked about a lot, was Austin Rivers. People, you know, some cautiously optimistic, some just very optimistic, but I think we've talked about him enough. You know, the other questions I got, I'll kind of put it all into one category, and it was a interesting Twitter conversation that I had today with a couple of people, and it was more based around what's going on with the Saints. But I guess the first question I'll ask you is, you know, this year, we've talked in the past about what we can expect, you know, from this team, and it's, you know, it's anything between probably 30 wins, 50 wins. We really don't know. There's so many variables. One of the questions I got was from, sorry, I'm trying to find the name, Chase Claus. Said, what would you constitute this season? What would have to happen for this season to be considered a failure to you?
Failure. Failure would have to be injuries. Honestly, even if the team plays terribly, if we get to see large chunks of the season with Eric Gordon, Tyreek Evans, Austin Rivers, and Drew Holiday all playing next to Anthony Davis, at least we'll know the answers to our questions, which are, can these guys fit together? Who are the best fits next to Anthony Davis? So a complete failure, I guess another way it could be a failure is if Anthony Davis plays worse than he did last year. That would be pretty crushing for me. But outside of Anthony Davis not playing very well, I mean, that would be, if there were so many injuries that you really can't answer it, because, I mean, I watched all last year of Eric Gordon. I have no idea how well he fits next to Anthony Davis. No clue. I'm 100% wanting to find that out this season. And the same thing with the two new acquisitions. And we've said it before, I've said it before, I'll say it again. This is all about finding the second and third banana to put next to Anthony Davis to be a dangerous team. And if we don't even get the opportunity to see that, that would be a complete failure of a season for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess for me, a failure would be if for any number of reasons we find out that Monty Williams just isn't a good coach. I would be devastated by that, because then you would kind of have to start over in a lot of ways. I think Monty Williams, I think players definitely respect him. But as I've said, we still don't know if he's a good coach. And when you say good, to me, that's one of the top 12 coaches in the league. That's, I mean, average is, you know, 13 through 17, whatever. Is he a top tier coach? Can he, you know, can he make adjustments and adjust to adjustments? And, you know, can he really handle rotations? Does he have a feel for the game? You know, can he continue to put players in spots where they'll thrive? Is he truly as stubborn as we've seen, you know, in the past with some things, where he gets an idea in his head and he sticks with it? Or is he more fluid now that he has, you know, a more talented roster and a more diverse roster? So to me, you know, if he loses control of the team, and then, you know, there's infighting in the team, or like I said, we just don't find out he's a good coach. That's really the only realistic way I think this team could fail. I mean, I would be disappointed by if Anthony Davis didn't make progress, but I just think, you know, that's not really possible from what we've seen from over the summer till now. So
it's spoken like a basketball coach. It's all about the coach.
It's not,
I agree with you. I know exactly where you're coming with, and that could have a serious impact on the ability of this team to work together. And you're right. If he doesn't work out, it always takes a little while before people admit that he's not working out. And then hitting the reset button causes all kinds of shockwaves. Now your team's in flux. Yeah, it would be a bad thing.
And I mean, maybe I'm pessimistic. Maybe I'd be wrong. But even though we would have a talented roster, I still don't think New Orleans would be a place that would lure like a Van Gundy or, you know, one of these coaches that is proven that, you know, could get the team winning and might even be an upgrade over Monty Williams. I still believe that even though this roster would be talented, you're looking more at like what the Atlanta Hawks have done. I mean, they get rid of Woodson, and it's not like even though they had a talented roster that went to the playoffs every year, it's not like any of those named coaches are beating down the doors. They go get Larry Drew, and you know, I think it would be the same thing. I think, you know, if the Pelicans had to hit the reset button, they would, you know, they would probably have to go and hire another assistant with an unproven track record. And yes, sometimes those guys turn into Tom Thibodeau, but more often than not, you know, they're just, you know, a guy who eventually is no longer, you know, no longer a coach after 3, 4, 5 years, or just in that average to below average range. So that would really disappoint me a lot if we just found out that Monty wasn't the answer this year. But I know, honestly, I don't expect that to happen.
Okay.
Yeah,
I don't either. But, you know.
But, yeah.
We'll see.
And, I mean, this whole conversation started, and it'll be the last thing, but, you know, some people brought it up. You know, I know you're not a big NFL fan, but Saints had a pretty heartbreaking game today, or I guess relatively heartbreaking. I mean, they were undefeated going into the game. They go to New England, who's, you know, it's not even arguable. They're the best. New England is the best team of the last 10, 12, actually probably 14 years now. I think that's when they won their first title. You know, they go in there and, you know, and the Saints wind up losing a heartbreaking game by a couple of points. And, you know, just watching on Twitter the reactions by some Saints fans, now that the expectations are so high for the Saints, and rightfully so, you know, it seems like there's almost no place to go but down. And to me, I don't know why this kind of bothers me. Maybe it's always been this way, but I don't remember it growing up. It seems like the NBA, you know, and with regards to fans, you know, it becomes a title or bust culture where we're almost not happy with anything else. You know, if OKC, I asked the question, if OKC or Chicago doesn't win a title but plays, you know, this well for the next 5 to 7 years, would you consider that a success or failure? And most people said that they would consider it a failure. 10 years of winning between 50 and 63 games a year, if it didn't end in a title, it would be a failure. I guess just overall, and this is probably looking too far ahead, but just in your opinion, I think it's pretty consensus among Pelican fans at this point that we have a future superstar in Anthony Davis. You know, looking down the line, if you're looking at this as an 8-year run coming up, would you see this next 8 years as a failure if the Pelicans were really good, but it ended without a title?
No. And let me, I think we've actually kind of had a similar conversation like this before where we're talking about team building. I mean, maybe it's because I've never been watching my favorite team win a championship, which, you know, has something to do with it. I guess I watched the Celtics when I was a little kid, and I was a fan of theirs then. But I just want to watch good basketball and have my team have a chance in every game they're playing. The things that always bother me is when my team rolls into another team and I just feel like they're going to be steamrolled. They don't really have much of a chance. Sure, they might win and you get these moments of, wow, I can't believe they beat that team. But I just want to be able to, you know, feel the swagger that this is a good team. You watch Oklahoma City walk into places and they pretty much are pretty sure they're going to whip up on whoever they're facing. And that's what I want to taste for an extended period of time. And if it ends up with not having a championship at the end of it, I'm not actually that upset with it, as long as I got to enjoy the swagger for a while. And I don't want it to be like the Chris Paul years where we had the swagger for one season. If it's one season of the eight, we get that, then no, I'm not happy. But if we get like an extended 5-year run where our team is, you know, top four in one of the leagues or one of the conferences, obviously the Western Conference, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, I mean, to me, every year in the NBA, I think usually there's usually 4 to 6 teams that could win a title. I think the year the Mavericks won it, you might even be able to argue more than that. But yeah. I think somewhere in that range of about 5 teams, I think if you put yourself in position to be one of those 5 teams, you've done a good job. But really, every year the team who wins the NBA title, something had to break their way. Or teams that didn't win it, something broke against them. And you can't really consider that season a failure. I mean, who knows what would happen with Oklahoma City last year if Russell Westbrook doesn't get hurt, right. You know, and on and on. I mean, there's so many factors outside of your control that go into it. I think the most that you could ask for a team is to put yourself in that position. I mean, was it Karl Malone or Charles Barkley's fault or their team's fault that they just happened to come along when Michael Jordan was in the, you know, was in the league and in his prime? I mean, would we be looking at Akeem Olajuwon's career differently if Jordan doesn't retire for those 2 years? Is he all of a sudden not that great of a player or among the elite because he didn't win a title? I just think...
Is he David Robinson? Well, I guess Patrick Ewing would be a better, right.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, it's like in realistically 4 or 5 teams could win it every year, and then something is going to happen along those lines that is luck-based, that eliminates some and, you know, catapults others. And to me, I just think if you're putting yourself in that position as a fan to say that it's either going to be a title or bust, that's going to be the only way that you're happy. Obviously, Pelicans fans aren't thinking that way this year, but I think they could be in 2 or 3 years. I just think that's, you know, that's just setting yourself up for disappointment. To me, you know, try to enjoy the process, try to enjoy the ride. Like you said, this team will be in a position where they could theoretically win every night, but, you know, obviously that doesn't mean that they will. You know, but if it's only about the result, you know, pure math just says you're going to be disappointed as a fan far, far more often than you're going to be happy. And just seeing the Saints fans today, at first the game started off slow. And again, this is a 5-0 team that's either the favorite or co-favorite to get to the Super Bowl. And, you know, just see them starting to question everything that they had seen the games before. And, you know, it just seems like, when winning is expected and losing just brings misery, I guess it's just something that I'm going to be very cautious about as a Pelicans fan moving forward, that I just want to enjoy the process and enjoy the fact that we have a team that we could root for. We don't have the Jailblazers. We don't have a bunch of punks on this team. We have really good guys who are good in the community, who are good representatives of the city and of the team. Like, to me, that's good in and of itself. If a title comes, that's icing on the cake. But personally, I'm just going to really try to enjoy the process.
Yes. And when we lost 5 in a row in the middle of January at some point, I'll remind you of that.
Yeah, and when I want to trade everybody and, you know, and nothing but doom and gloom is near. But yeah, I mean, regardless, I think we've said this in every podcast, but it's going to be a really fun season. The last couple of games have done nothing but to, you know, get us even more excited. And, you know, who knows, by the next time we're on this podcast, we might have actually seen a fully healthy Pelicans roster, because word is that Tyree could play this week, and, you know, Eric Gordon might have a shot to play as well. So, we might actually be able to watch a Pelicans game and watch a Pelicans game that features all five of the main pieces that the Dell brought together this offseason.
Yep. And I'm calling it now. Phoenix Suns are also undefeated in preseason. Suns, Pelicans, Western Conference Finals.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the preseason would agree with you.
All right, thanks everybody for listening to In the Know, and we'll be back a little later this week.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, UNIFYD, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE system.